Since you're Jason Horsley of Sweta, I can tell you about my past, and luckily I don't have to pay you, right? I mean, I've been dealing with aliens as a big subject since the 90s, and because one of the father figures in my life, not my actual father, but a guy I met when I was in my early 20s, said he'd been abducted, you know? So yeah, I remember from childhood a time when a man in a gorilla costume was standing at the foot of my bed. And the room was filled with fog, maybe from like a humidifier. Mm-hmm. And then I couldn't move. And I tried to scream for my parents, and a big soap bubble came out of my mouth. So I have that memory. Wow. And then I have a memory of being at summer camp and being taken out into the woods, all of us being taken out into the woods by the counselors, and being taken to a bush where inside the bush there was a cutout of a cat, like a cardboard cat with big oval-shaped eyes that with sequins or something on them, so they were reflecting the flashlight in a very dramatic way. And both of those memories seem like if I wanted to be an experiencer, if I wanted to, I don't know, go out on the circuit or something and make claims, I could claim those were screen memories or something, right? They fit.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I don't trust either one to be in any way accurate, you know. Certainly not the camping one, because, I don't know, it just, well, it's the most obvious screen image. You know, I go and I see this cardboard cut out of a cat with alien eyes. They take us out in the woods. I mean, what the hell is that?
What do you think it was then? Did you think it was a dream, or you fabricated it and then ended up believing it?
I don't know.
See, because this is sort of a time example of second matrix stuff, because something happens that's incomprehensible, and because if we don't have any way to explain it, then we just leave it as incomprehensible, and it's an area of our past that is mysterious and that we can't quite forget, but we can't explain it either. So it just remains there as this unknown, but as this indication that something went on. Then we read Whitley Strieber and we read all the various literature and we say, oh, it was a screen memory. So what really happened was aliens. And so then we create this interpretation of it, which is still just an interpretation, and maybe it's a little closer to reality than a cardboard cut out of a cat, you know. But it's still a kind of screen interpretation of something that is incomprehensible. And so then we're actually restricting the experience. We think that we're explaining it, but really we're actually limiting it.
Yeah, I'm much more satisfied with the story of going out in the woods for these counselors who I didn't get along with very well, and certainly not the other campers I wasn't fitting in with very well. Going out into the woods to see a cutout of a cardboard cat with alien eyes strikes me as somehow more satisfying and stranger than you know, going on a spaceship and you know, looking at the, I don't know, what would I, being anally probed or something. And it's not because I don't want to face that. It's right. I just find it's more interesting, and also happens to be what I remember.
Isn't there's presumably still a desire to somehow explain it and to fill in the missing pieces, no?
Yeah, and I've written short stories, you know, which deal with not that particular memory, but deal with those kinds of things. But they don't tend to offer answers.
Right.
So that's been my way of dealing with it, or incorporating it into my life, is kind of putting it in the bracket of being a fiction that I can deal with, but it's based on some memory that I don't understand, but I've processed it, but I haven't answered it.
So, and have you always written, well, obviously not always, but since you were young, did you write fiction and science fiction?
I wrote stories when I was younger. You know, I wasn't one of those genius kids that would just write a story a day or something. I've met people who were more naturally writers than I am. And when I was a teenager, I made videos and wrote scripts, but I didn't write short stories. But it was when I, sometime in late high school, that I decided I was going to be a writer, like when I was around 17.
That's pretty young. And it was science fiction that attracted you?
No, I wanted to be a serious writer. So I wrote stories about relationships at that point. And I got my first story published when I was 18 in a little zine called The Fiction Primer. And that was like, well, wow, I've gotten paid $20. This is it. I'm made. I'll be a hero. And, you know, by next year, I'll be making my living at it. And, you know, that didn't happen. But, yeah, I've been writing. I'm not very prolific. Certainly not lately.
And when did you start writing science fiction?
I started writing science fiction when I was in my mid-20s. A friend of mine who was a science fiction writer said, you know, Doug, you're writing about aliens. You're writing science fiction. And I went to a writer's workshop in Seattle called Clarion and started to try to break into the science fiction field at that point.
Right.
Yeah, I was about 24. And, yeah, it was, I fell into it naturally. And some of my favorite writers are guys like Philip K. Dick and Stanislaw Lem. So, yeah. But yeah, so that's how I've been trying to incorporate it. And, but the nasty bit of business with that is that, talk about wanting to be a somebody, you know, that's what that is. Being a fiction writer, more than anything, it's wanting to be a somebody, because it's not about even, like if you're writing, Matrix Warrior being the one. Well, it's about your wisdom, but it's also about, you're talking about the real world. You're offering something other than your just great stylings or your prowess as an artist.
I think there's people who would disagree with you there, but I'll take it.
Well, I mean, yeah, I think that you're offering something other than just your ego. But when with literature, yeah, you supposedly are too, but a lot of what goes on, it just seems like it's how good are you, you know?
Well, but that, I mean, that's true of anything you do. It's and if anything, I'd say fiction potentially is much cleaner, because it's, you can't fake it. If you write philosophy or something, or something like Matrix Warrior, then the intellect can really take over and impress people just with words and arguments, whereas to actually tell a good story, it requires much more than just the intellect.
I'll agree with that as far as the form. I think that for me, what is polluted about writing fiction is that I did invest so much of my ego into it, you know, and I haven't done that with as much at all with like the podcast I'm doing or the alternative perceptions community. That's not where I'm at. That's not what satisfies my need to be a somebody. My need to be a somebody is on hold right now until my novel comes out, right?
So then, yeah, like that. So then it's, to go sweater on you, then it's probably to do with how you were first drawn to writing fiction and what was driving you back then when you were a teenager.
Oh, totally. That's what, I mean, I'm aware of that one of the nice things about podcasting is that I can explore all these things that I'd like to explore in my fiction, but in a much more pure way.
Because it doesn't have that baggage attached.
Right. Exactly.
So when did you, start becoming politically aware, and what would you describe yourself as? A social anarchist?
Libertarian anarchist. Libertarian socialist. That's which is an anarchist, right? But that's just one label. I'm not really a libertarian socialist because I've never lived on a commune or lived out these ideas. These are just things that are attractive to me.
They're attracted to you?
Or they're attractive to me.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
And when did that begin?
When I left college in 91 or late 90 and moved to Portland, right around the time the Gulf War started is when I started down that road to be more of an anarchist. Mm. And I was following Miriam, who's I'm married to now, my wife, who does the Titanic factoids on the show. Right. We were in love and everything, and she told me that we were going to have to break it off since we couldn't actually be together. She couldn't afford to go to the college I was going to in Florida, so So I dropped out of college and came here. I mean, it was partly because I wanted to be with her. It was partly because that I was hating every minute of being in Florida in that particular college, and not succeeding very well. But anyway, yeah, so I came here and worked for an environmental organization called Osberg, which was the kind of place you can go and get a job if you don't have any skills. You're just going door to door and asking for checks. Mm. Became alienated from that after about 5 or 6 months because it was a sham. And but then started reading Chomsky and Alexander Berkman and Robert Anton Wilson and Terrence McKenna, and it all kind of got mixed together. It's not separated for me. It's not like I can put Noam Chomsky over here and Terrence McKenna over here. It's like I want to. In fact, I am writing a short story right now, but it's really slow going, about going back in time and having Noam Chomsky and Terrence McKenna interact. This guy who's a reviewer of high-tech products, he's got a personal time machine that he's reviewing and just bashing because it doesn't work to change anything, because he tries to go back and get Terrence McKenna and Noam Chomsky to work it out.
Right.
Come up with a synthesis, and it doesn't work. But, yeah.
Mm. So, but you're also open to, if not actively interested in, the conspiratorial view of,
yeah,
of a society, if not reality, no?
Yeah, I am.
So how do the two things mesh? I mean, how can you reconcile being a libertarian socialist with possibly living in a Dickian universe in which reality itself has been hijacked by non-human forces?
You have to have the right kind of time machine. That's what I'm trying to do. That's what I'm trying to reconcile, I think. But I don't think that the idea that there are conspiracies, maybe not galactic ones, but that there are conspiracies like the 9/11 was an inside job, is really diametrically opposed to a more structural analysis of our problems. But you would think so, because most of the traditional structuralists, you know, anarchist or socialist groups are just allergic to even looking at any evidence about what happened on 9/11.
Yeah, and conspiracy theory in general is considered lunatic fringe, if not sort of right-wing kind of thing, isn't it?
Yeah, that's fluctuated, I think. There was a time when it was considered left-wing more.
Right.
Yeah, certainly these days, it's one of the things that made me profoundly uncomfortable looking into 9/11 a few years ago. But I'll tell you this, and, you know, when I started investigating 9/11, I was having trouble with my marriage. Yeah. And I knew that I was throwing myself into this material as a way to kind of have a refuge. And so...
I guess we're not doing a podcast.
No, I guess not. Although, if you want to put this up on your podcast, I wouldn't be allergic to that.
Oh, really?
But you don't have to. But that ties into this idea of this big picture stuff, this second matrix being a way to avoid ordinary reality.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've seen it. I'm seeing it more and more, actually. It's just, specifically what you just described as somebody at Twitter who's kind of doing the same thing and pointing it out to them that 9/11 is just the obvious thing we all know about looking for distractions from an uncomfortable marriage or anything else, you know, but to find distractions that seem real, that seem important, and that most of all that actually we can superimpose over our personal problems. So, for example, if we're feeling oppressed and controlled and deceived within our lives and within our personal lives, then to start investigating a big picture narrative which is about control, deception, you know, these elements, but in a very impersonal way, then we can sort of project all of our feelings of discomfort onto that big picture thing, and then we really don't have to look at what's going on at home. We feel like, Oh, no, the only reason I'm feeling this way is because there's a global conspiracy to take away my freedom. And so then we're dealing with a problem that we really know, if we're honest, we can't do anything about. But
Right.
we feel we are doing a little something, we're doing our little bit, rather than looking at a problem that we really can do something about, not by fixing it, but just by looking at it and being honest about it. But that would be a very uncomfortable process, of course, just really allowing ourselves to see how distorted we've allowed our relationships to become. That's a lot less comfortable than focusing on some great big picture conspiracy, which we see in terms of how negative it is and how heinous and undesirable it is, but actually it's kind of pleasing to us. You know, the more we can uncover these dark Machiavellian conspiracies, the better we feel, in a way.
Mm-hmm.
For this reason, I think, is it gives us something to project onto.
Yeah, well, I was aware of it, you know, at the time. I kind of knew what I was doing. But I could justify it by saying, well, even though in my personal life, even though my motivations are suspect, all this stuff is true.
Right.
So it doesn't matter my motives don't matter logically. So all
so
this
wouldn't
stuff,
that be an example of going against something that you know?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. Although, on the other hand, it seemed to me that doing all that was necessary.
Mm-hmm. It seemed then, or it seems now?
It seems now. That coping with it the way I did, I don't think retarded or slowed down my ability to heal. I think it was important to for me to have some place to go to kind of regroup.
Mm. Well, yeah, that's somewhat different, isn't it? I mean, it's like maybe you can see it that way now, but that wasn't how you were seeing it at the time.
No, it was. I mean, that's the thing that's kind of crazy. I knew it at the time that I was doing that, but I justified it. But yeah, I knew it at
okay.
the time.
So then, but if you were justifying it, then you weren't being honest with yourself.
Yeah, I guess not.
Because it's like me with movies. I mean, I have used movies as a refuge and as escape, and then I've kind of criticized myself about that and justified it. It sort of goes hand in hand. If you have some sort of compulsion, on the one hand, you beat yourself up about it, and then you justify it, and back and forth. Now about movies, I'm just honest. Well, actually, sometimes I really want to shut down my brain, and that's something that I need, really. I mean, need is a loaded word, but it definitely helps. But what really helps is admitting that, knowing that.
Mm-hmm.
This is really just downtime where I'm not actually going to sleep, but I want to be as close to like just being a zombie as I can. And
yeah.
And that's not, that can actually be, you know, a little self-medication is okay. It's just when it becomes compulsive and you just want to stay numbed out the whole time that it gets, that you have something that you really need to look at.
Yeah. And, you know, the other thing is the standards that we have for how numbed out is healthy, you know, how long we can stay numbed out and be healthy are pretty poor standards. Not saying your standards are, but as a culture.
Yeah, which is saying it's okay to be numbed out the whole time, really.
Or close to the whole time. So you got to be careful about, you know, just how much mindless stupidity should you really let in.
Well, it's just sort of the irony of the second matrix, though, isn't it? Because then it's ostensibly it's about waking up.
Yeah.
But it becomes another form of entertainment, so then it becomes another way to shut down.
Oh, yeah. And it's clear. I mean, that's something that it's that you've pointed out lately that seems really clear to me, that you can't look at something like Red Ice or even someone who I think is a lot more reputable, someone like Neil, without knowing that it's really for entertainment.
Mm.
That this isn't, but you know, but it's hard because we don't really even know what to do that isn't entertainment, right?
But maybe that's all we need to do, you know, be in the shallow, and we need to do what we need to survive, and we wipe our butts and put food on the table. But beyond that, why should there be anything besides enjoyment?
Well,
you have this notion of social responsibility, which I don't have, but I don't consider myself socially irresponsible either.
Well, I just, as I said earlier, I just got off this interview yesterday or a couple of days ago with a guy named Daniel Coffeen, and he's sort of this postmodern type, and his whole all of his work up to now has just been about joy and the reveling in the surface of an image and really being part of a flow of rhetoric, but not worrying about philosophy, not worrying about trying to find the true, just enjoying this process. But he's come to the conclusion that the system is stopping him from having his enjoyment, that he can't have real enjoyment under capitalism. And he puts it in those terms.
So then what? Then he has to destroy the system in order to enjoy himself?
He doesn't get there. He's just saying that capitalism, this logic of capitalism, is keeping us just from having enjoyment, and its goal is to destroy the human host, to destroy the body, and the body's enjoyment.
Well, it's funny you use the term host, because I was thinking of a virus when you were speaking.
Yeah, he uses that metaphor directly, yeah.
Because the way that it undermines our enjoyment, I think, is by infiltrating us with that morphogenetic field of achievement of progress, so that we're constantly having to advance, we're constantly having to do things in order to earn our well-being. Mm-hmm. And so then that's taking away the possibility of enjoyment in the moment. So it's taking us out of our pure physical beingness, mm-hmm. where enjoyment is. I mean, all enjoyment, I think it's enjoying being in the body and enjoying being physical is to be distinguished from physical enjoyment. That's the key.
Right.
There's all the difference in the world, but unless you've experienced that or really thought about it, they seem synonymous. So then to just indulge one's senses and just eat lots of ice cream and have loads of sex and do drugs, obviously that's not enjoyment.
Right.
Obviously, it's not healthy.
Daniel talks about, like, he gets together with these multimillionaires, you know, the people funding. Because he works in advertising for his real job. He was a college professor, but that fell apart, and now he's in advertising. And he gets together with these people, and they'll go out to a really nice restaurant, you know, and order these elaborate and exotic and expensive dishes. And these guys will just scarf it down. You know, just inhale it.
Yeah.
and they don't know how to enjoy anything. Mm-hmm. And that's how we approach our pleasures, I think. At least I know I do a good portion of the time.
It's like, yeah, compulsively.
Compulsively and without thought. So you don't have any enjoyment.
No, we tend to be consuming one pleasure while already thinking of what's next.
Right.
It gives the game away when you notice yourself doing that we're actually just compulsively driven by something within us to seek out these pleasures, the pursuit of happiness. The one thing that ensures that we'll never actually experience happiness is to be constantly pursuing it.
Right. Yeah, that's true. And the same thing about social change. The one thing that will assure there is never going to be a better community is if you constantly are pursuing it, right?
Well, so how do you reconcile that with your... Because haven't you been an activist in your time?
Well, I've been an activist, but I've always kind of fallen out from it. Like, after 9/11, my response was not to investigate 9/11. That was a long time later. It was because I thought there was something fishy, but the main thing that was fishy was, to me, was that none of the solutions being offered had anything to do with protecting people from terrorism or dealing with the problem. They were obviously about perpetuating some other agenda.
Right.
And you don't have to think it was an inside job to see that. So my response was, my response was to go into the activist realm and try to work with others to protest the war and try to stop the war in Afghanistan and then the war in Iraq. But what I found was that the realm of activism was a second matrix, that it was tightly controlled, probably from the secret police or something, probably really outright controlled by the government, but more insidiously than that, everyone who was in these groups, their own minds were so constricted that there was really no one was aiming to accomplish any of the things they were supposed to be trying to accomplish. It was always about being a somebody.
Right.
That was what it was about. It was about being a somebody in this milieu. It was being the head of the group or finding some power within that. But it was never about, because no one believed that they could stop the war.
Right.
So it was a lot of jockeying for ego position. So I left that. And I wrote about it a little bit in a place called Indie Media. And, I just threw myself into writing and my job and my family and everything. So I've kind of returned to politics through the conspiracy side of things and doing my podcast. But I haven't really, since around 2002, I haven't been an activist where I'm organizing protests or anything.
Mm-hmm. So would you say that you've refined it close to something of desire to increase awareness?
Yeah, but to increase awareness of certain things, like certain opportunities, certain kinds of historical moments is what I'm doing now. I talk about 1968 all the time, and where the people just said they were going to occupy their own lives and tried to reject the whole system. And I think that's a moment which is really seems authentic to me and seems really promising. So I do that. But the other thing that I'm doing that's just as important, probably more important, is I'm using this podcast as an opportunity to talk to people who've been thinking about these things too, because I don't feel like I really have an answer, so it's good to. That's why I reach out to people like you and Neil, and that's why I reach out to anybody who's on my podcast, is because I feel like they have some little piece of this that I can at least have a conversation with them about.
Mm-hmm. So it's a communal exploration process.
Yeah.
Which is really self-exploration. When we're honest about it, when we're really in it.
Yeah.
And we're getting to know ourselves better by interacting with possible kindred spirits or non-kindred spirits. Adversarial spirits could also be a way to discover parts about oneself, but certainly interacting with one's species.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And having conversations that are more elevated or real, or instead of because you interact with people all the time, but finding ways to interact that where you can cut through, and this kind of construct of the podcast where you're putting on a show seems to provide that for me, and without me being invested very much. I mean, as you do it longer, you get more invested. You worry about your stats and
all that. That's the danger. You have an audience, you have a following, and then you feel like you have to live up to something.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, being a fiction writer and knowing that one of the reasons I'm building an audience is because I do have a novel coming out in 2011.
Right.
Yeah, that's definitely another, that undercuts it a bit, too.
Because you want to make a living off your writing?
Oh, yeah. I'd like to stop having to work my shit job.
Mm. Was that the primary motivation then, besides being a somebody, being recognized as a writer?
Yeah. Being able to do this without having to spend 40 hours a week, answering calls for the big corporation and being bored and being slowly killed, really. Because those jobs, they're not just bad for your mind. They're not just boring. You get stuck. You know, you get in terrible. I'm in terrible shape at 39. You know, because I don't go out and do anything physical very often. You know, when I do, I enjoy it, but I'm stuck. You know, 14 hours a day on my ass for right. 4 days a week. I mean, I think about if I got fired, what would I do? And you know, I didn't have any responsibilities, and I just walk. Just try to walk all day somewhere just to see what happened. I just
so do you walk on your days off?
I do, but not as often as I would imagine I would if I was fired, right? I mean, I go out and I walk around and I take the family out and we go somewhere. There's a wetland near where we live and we go down there sometimes. But I imagine if I didn't have a job, I would be able to. I mean, the thing is, if I didn't have this job, I'd have to get another, and I wouldn't just be able to just walk across America like Forrest Gump or something. You know, right?
It depends, really, doesn't it? I mean, reality is a state of mind. Your job is a state of mind.
Right.
In a way, you're talking about thoughts as if they had some greater reality to what you are as consciousness, because it's, I mean, responsibility. What are you responsible to? You're responsible to your wife because yeah. she's under your care.
Right.
You're responsible to your body, ditto. It's under your care.
Mm-hmm.
What else?
My four children.
And your four children, you're still supporting them.
Yeah.
Four of them. Wow, I didn't know you had that many. Who, what ages are they?
I've got Noah, who's 5, Simon, who's 7, Emma, who's 11, and Ben, who's 13.
Well, okay, now I can see why it might seem like more than just a state of mind.
Yeah, it's more than just a state of mind. I mean, we live on very little. They're all doing well, though. No one's feeling like they're deprived. I come from, you know, a little bit of money. My father's a doctor, so it's not like I have to have all the problems that someone in my position normally would. You know, we have a house that I didn't have to buy. But other than that, yeah, pretty much, you know, I'm responsible for these people.
But does having them under your care, does it mean that you think of them as belonging to you?
Well, no, they won't let me do that.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But does it translate as you feeling that you have to be or do something for them, that they actually need you?
Yeah, I feel like I have to earn money to buy groceries and
but is
get them clothes.
Is this really true? I mean, do any of them actually need you?
Well, I think they do, because I don't think that any of them were brought up to be as independent as they might be. You know? So, like, if I was in a different culture or something of a tribal culture, they probably, like Ben certainly, and maybe Emma too, would be much, you know, not as needy as they are in this culture.
Yeah, but so you're talking about emotional need.
No, I'm talking about physical.
Well, supposing you were to die tomorrow.
I think that Miriam would be, you know, would have a lot of on her plate.
Mm-hmm. But would that be your responsibility too, if you were to die unexpectedly?
Well, I don't. Yeah. No, I don't feel like that would be my responsibility. From somehow that as long as I'm here, I'm responsible. But if I'm gone, that's not my fault.
Well, I think responsibility is a strange thing. I think that we tend to turn it into a sense of obligation, and I think that's part of the virus that we've talked about,
mm-hmm.
purpose-driven. Wanting to be a somebody, so then we end up wanting to be a good father and a good husband, and that's all about being a somebody too, and we turn a responsibility into an obligation in the process, so that what happens is that potentially you become a burden to those that are under your care, because you're experiencing them as a burden, or you're experiencing your role as a father or a husband as a burden to you. Because you're compromising what you know.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's something literal and superficial like doing a job you wouldn't do, or more, as is more likely, just being in a way of being which isn't fully true to you because of this sense of responsibility. And so then that, to say that, it's actually, I think, I'm not a father yet, but I think having spoken to other fathers about this, and they've seen where I was coming from, that it's not actually true to what you know, that they need you, or that you have to be a certain way for them, that that's actually turning the whole thing into something that it isn't, something personal. When actually a marriage isn't really personal primarily. It has a personal level to it, and being a father, there's a personal element to it. But really, you know, the bulk of what's going on with your family is very impersonal.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, because, you know, there are these roles that you fill, and it's just, and they're not like constructs. They're just, it's like, you know, there's a queen bee, and right. That kind of thing. So
that's physical, that's instinctive, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it's just you're in your family. This is an organic process of creating life, and this is your family, and it's very natural thing to fall into certain roles and positions, you know. And it's harder in this, I think, for people like me than maybe it would be for people who are not living here and now. But I don't feel, most of the time, I don't feel like my actual children, you know, that Noah and Simon and Ben and Emma are people who I am burdened by. It's my, you know, I'm burdened by the need to, by the social order, but and what it requires of me in order to be in this family. But I don't feel that they are a burden.
But isn't that kind of splitting hairs, because it's, isn't it a combination of both factors? Because if the social order was different, then yes, you wouldn't be burdened by having to do things you didn't like. But if you didn't have four children and a wife, you wouldn't be so beholden to the social order as you are now.
Well, I'd still have to eat.
Well, that's very different. I mean, you could just hit the road and be a bum, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, fine. So,
well, I was brought up too bourgeois for any of that stuff, the hitting the road and being a bum.
I was brought up pretty bourgeois, too. It
yeah.
Prevent me.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So it sounded a bit similar to what we were just talking about in terms of projecting a local situation, a local set of circumstances onto a much bigger one, onto a bigger picture one. Because the social order is what it is.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I don't feel that in my interactions with my kids that they're a burden when I'm with them. I don't have an emotional response to them where I feel burdened by them.
Mm-hmm.
If anything, it's usually the opposite. I mean, it's not entirely true, especially the young ones. They can be kind of a burden. But, you know, I feel positive about my kids. They're one of the best parts of my life, so.
Well, I would hope so. Yeah. I wasn't suggesting that you actually experienced them as a burden, but that you would become a burden on them by feeling that you had to be something for them.
Right. Well, okay. So how do I avoid that?
You know, Jung said that there's nothing more dangerous to us, to a child, than the unlived life of its parents.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is part of that, that if you feel, however unconsciously, however much you suppress it, if you feel that you're actually sacrificing something in order to be a parent, be a father or a husband, then all of that stuff that you're disowning is going, they're going to end up carrying it around for you.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that.
So, I mean,
I just, you know, I do a lot of my life. I try to make room for a lot of my life, but I, the problem here is you start turning this around. It's like I start to feel guilty for going to work, you know, trying to feel and trying to get them, a life that is relatively comfortable.
So,
and
but
myself.
Then the whole thing of guilt is when we're using some external value system to measure what we know to be true. Or instead of referring to what we know to be true, where we're referring to some emotional, psychological system like guilt or responsibility or obligation, and that's kind of that's an indication that you're having to.
Yeah, I know. You know, this is why I didn't join SWETA. Right here, because I know what you're saying, and I think that I have a knowing about what you're saying, and I would certainly be happier, and my kids would be happier if I didn't have to go to this fucking Comcast job. You know, I'd be around more, I'd be more pleasant to be around, but I just don't see at the moment how I can do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I do have to. There are six of us, and it's nice to be able to go out and have dinner at a Chinese restaurant every once in a while. You know,
but I think it's like we were talking about before with the, you know, was your seeking refuge in 9/11 or me with movies, that if you're having to justify something to yourself at all, then that goes hand in hand with the feeling guilty about it. So neither way of looking at it is true or honest. So
right.
If you can let go of the one, you can let go of the other. So the only thing that might change, that you might allow to change, would be you actually just looking at the ways in which you've compromised more unflinchingly, and so being more honest about them. So then you would be approaching them in different ways. It wouldn't actually be about you changing anything on the surface. That wouldn't be necessary. Because the tendency is we think that, if we think that, like you're saying, well, there is something wrong, I have a knowing about that, but I, how am I going to fix it anyway? So then we react by not wanting to look more closely at whatever it is that we know isn't quite right, because we think, well, if I look at it and I see actually that there really is something wrong, then I'm not going to be able to do anything about it anyway, so I'm going to feel worse. So then we actually have an investment in not seeing it.
Well, see,
because we've got this misconception that if we see something wrong, we then have to fix it. But the truth is what I've experienced, what everyone at SWETA is experiencing, is that it's the opposite. And once we actually see what's wrong, we don't have to do anything about it.
I feel like I know that I should quit my job, right? I'd be able to do this more effectively. I'd be able to write again more effectively. But I just don't have anything set up so I can quit my job and still have the family be supported.
Right.
Right.
So again, those two factors are sort of feeding into each other, and that is a breeding ground for resentment.
Yeah. Yeah, but but because I know that I ought to do that, and I know that it's my task now to find a way to do that, I feel like maybe I'm not as resentful as I might be. Also, you know, it's not, I've got this being somebody helping me out too, right? I've got this idea that, all I have to do is wait until 2011 when my book comes out. It's not a rational thing.
Yeah, no, that's not helping you out, Doug. That's just giving you an excuse to
wait.
Postpone something that requires your attention now, which is probably not that you need to quit your job. I would suggest tentatively that the knowing that you have isn't that you need to quit your job, but that your perception of your job, your relationship with that aspect of your reality, which is your job, it needs to be looked at and can change. You know, it's intolerable as it is, but to actually quit the job, it's like breaking up in a relationship because it's not working out. Sometimes that's the right thing, if the relationship was based on a deception to begin with, on a projection, on a misunderstanding, and basically you overrid your knowing and entered into a relationship that just wasn't right for you, then of course you cut your losses and you get out when you're able to admit that to yourself. Same with the job. But then other times we actually are in the right relationship, but we don't want to go deeper. It's getting uncomfortable. So, and the deeper we go into it, the more uncomfortable it becomes. So then we just break up. And so can you tell the difference? You know, is this job basically just something that you did for the wrong reasons and that you've had to lie to yourself about because you didn't want to admit that? Or is it something that, like with your 9/11, that actually you did need, and that you can start to see in new ways instead of just defining it by the negatives, like the things that it takes away from you? You could start to see those negatives as positives because it's actually giving you an opportunity to let go of stuff.
Well,
like the desire to be somebody, for example.
See, this is where the social activist side or the political side of me starts kicking in, and I don't know to what extent it's keeping me from my knowing. But I was laid off from my job, which was much more comfortable for me, which was working at the Oregon Symphony in a very similar capacity, selling tickets and subscriptions. And after being laid off from that, which I think actually was natural because I've been there a long time. I've been there 10 years, and it was getting to be too comfortable. It was, in a way, it was an opportunity to leave. I mean, I hate to be bright-sided about it, but then I got on unemployment for a little while, and in the terms of unemployment is you have to look for a job, and so I did. And when you get hired, if you can't keep your unemployment by turning down job offers. The first person to hire you gets you if you're on unemployment. So I got hired by this company. I knew I didn't want to work there. I started calling other people I'd interviewed and said, you know, hey, remember me? Are you sure you don't want to hire me? Because I've just been hired. This is your last chance. And, you know, that didn't work out. So I went into this job. But it was almost like I was drafted. I mean, that's how it felt. So I don't feel like I have a relationship where there's equality of choice here. I feel like it's a compulsory relationship.
But you set it up that way. I mean, you determined the set of circumstances which actually led to you getting drafted.
How do you figure that I was the primary cause of being that set up that way?
Well, because you're the player. I mean, you're the, like you said at the beginning of our chat, everything's about you.
Yeah, but I was being sarcastic. I don't believe everything's about me. I mean, when I'm on that.
However far you want to trace it back, it might have to go all the way back to your childhood to convince yourself, but essentially it was your actions that led you to that set of circumstances that then led to you being drafted.
Yeah, okay.
It's existential psychology. It's not mysticism.
Okay. Well, see, it starts to feel like mysticism to me at that point, because I can see that, yeah, I made choices that, in my individual case, I made choices that led me not to have other options. Like, I could have not pursued being a writer, and I could have pursued a more practical profession, so I wouldn't have to take these kinds of jobs, right? I could have been more ambitious on the job I had and tried to make it up the ladder instead of just staying at the same level because I wanted to be a somebody as a writer. So I didn't care about making it up into the upper echelon of the symphony job. So that would have protected me. Although not really, because a lot of the upper management there got laid off.
But that's quite symmetrical if you choose to focus on that, because then it's your desire to be a somebody which has led you into a situation in which you have to let go of the desire to be a somebody.
That's true.
So that is very much how the system works, not the social system, but the system that is consciousness. We are forced to confront the parts of ourselves that we're not willing to look at.
Yeah, okay. But see, now that you can see how that starts to seem like mysticism again, right?
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, because mysticism has described similar sort of principles and what have you in more mystical terms, and the whole area of the unconscious is, because it's unconscious and because it's obscured to us, if we start to talk about it, the terms that we use are going to be a little bit vague, and so then it can start to overlap with mysticism. But it really isn't, because we know that our unconscious, even if we're just most superficial reading of it in terms of what we remember of our lives, the majority of it is hidden, is in the unconscious. But we also know that that actually informs our actions. It's not only what we remember and are conscious of, it's the whole thing. So that means that if 90% of our being is unconscious, then what's actually shaping our circumstances, most of it is below the surface of consciousness. So we are actually unknown to ourselves, and we are unconsciously shaping our circumstances and creating realities for ourselves, hidden, unbeknownst to us.
Yeah.
And I'm already proving my point because it's sounding sort of vague, but
well, you know,
it
Jason,
is vague if you've experienced it.
My 13-year-old is yelling, "Papa, come over here!" So it was great talking to you, and I hope to talk to you again, of course. And you gave me a lot to chew on.
Well, you asked for it.
I did. Yeah. No, and not in a bad way at all. It was definitely interesting. I'm not entirely sold on being responsible for the job and all that, but I'm not. I certainly don't want to say something so stupid as I'm not at all responsible, right? So, it's. I have one last. This is not for the podcast. Maybe it is for the podcast. So one quick question: how do you handle the fact that you are impacting people's real lives so much, and that even though you have the disclaimer that it's just for entertainment, that you know, when I talked to Ezra and Chris, it didn't seem like it was just for entertainment at all.
Right. No. So how do I handle the responsibility
The responsibility of that? And maybe that's something that would be helpful for me, because I feel responsible, right? So.
Right. Well, it's really a matter of staying focused on my own process, and that this really is always about my process. And so what I do at the forum and what I did with you today talking is I respond. I don't have an agenda, like I'm going to try and show this person this or convince them of that, at least most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
So then that, in a way, that absolves me from a great deal of responsibility. It's a paradox, because I'm able to respond, I'm not responsible for the consequences of my responses.
Right.
See, if I'm just staying in what I know, then I'm really mirroring back at you. Now, I'm putting myself in your shoes, and I'm saying what I know for myself if I was in your position.
Yeah, but it's not like you're just an Eliza program, you know, where you're just only mirroring. You do direct. You do correct in your conversations with people.
It does happen, yeah. But as far as I'm able to, like, be clean, you know, stay in what I know, then I'm not. There's not an agenda behind it. I think that's the only thing that keeps me.
Clean,
safe, but in terms of unconcerned about the consequences, because if I'm actually just responding and being honest, then there are no consequences for honesty.
You know, in our conversation today, I definitely felt that we were being really honest and open and talking, and we just ended up where we ended up, and which is why I said things that, you know, I don't want on a podcast, right? Because I was not trying to filter my responses. I've heard you on your podcast talk to the recent one. What's the guy's name?
Steve Wilner?
Yeah. Where it seemed to me you walked in kind of knowing what you wanted to tell him. I mean, not that you were wrong, but you wanted to tell him, look, you're doing this for your own self, and this is not the same as what you were doing before. You knew that, right?
But no, that wasn't going to be a podcast, Doug. No. That was just going to be my farewell chat with Steve. And yes, I already knew what I thought of what he was doing, but that's not the same thing as knowing what I wanted to say. I didn't know what I wanted to say to him, and within the first 10 minutes, I caught myself doing that. And I thought, wait a minute, he's not at Sweater anymore. He's not paying me. Why should I be giving him advice? And I almost stopped myself. But I thought, well, fuck it. This, you know, he's a friend, and so I'm going to be as good a friend as I can be, which means being as honest as I can be. And so I had no agenda. Well, everyone always has some agenda, but I didn't have the agenda that you're suggesting at that point, because I
didn't name what your agenda was. I just said that you knew what you were going to say. And I guess that you wanted to correct him, that you knew that he was kind of making a wrong turn. It seemed to me you felt
no, because I didn't think he was making a wrong turn, but I thought that he was making a turn without being fully aware of the nature of the turn, and so I felt a desire to warn him, to caution him, and to point out to him things that he didn't want to see and that he was invested in not seeing. And so it was a brotherly or a paternal feeling I was having, mostly not a desire to correct him, but a desire to give him any last input that he could take with him and that might be useful to him.
Well, I continue to enjoy listening to those conversations, and I often get something really good out of them. Although I'll say that the Vagabond podcast, where you're just kind of riffing on your own, have had a bit more power for me lately than the Sweater ones or the Warty Theorems ones.
Well, that's kind of good to hear. Those are mostly for my own amusement. So that just goes to show that do what you enjoy, and others will enjoy it.
Well, thanks again. This is fun. Did you expect this to go this way when I called?
No, I didn't expect it to go this way at all. But that's the beauty of life. It's just an endless string of surprises. Not all of them pleasant, but enough to keep us going.
Yeah, this was pleasant, I thought.
Well, I hope that you will enjoy listening to yourself, getting the warty treatment as much as you've enjoyed listening to others.
I don't know.